Accession number 10167, Rule 5.
Ronald Elliott, Rule 5. I was asking you about the effect of the new sort of drafts and the general composition of the Ninth at the time. How were they integrating together, and what effect was it having on the competence of the battalion, do you think?
This sort of thing tends to go on throughout a unit's experience, that you're always having influxes of reinforcements, and I suppose the harder the action you have, the more reinforcements you have, and it tends to have a cumulative effect, I guess, that the original veterans of, say, North Africa were becoming fewer and farther between, and my feeling was that, as far as I can remember, I was hardly with them for any length of time. Most of it was with one platoon, but sort of have the feeling, looking back, that they were coming to the end of their tether, that they clearly were in need of some revitalization.
Did that show itself in any way, or is that just really an
That's
impression?
That's just hindsight, I would have thought. I have no evidence, really, to support that. It's just a gut feeling.
What about...
Because we came to that on... two or three occasions subsequently, so perhaps I...
With the 16th?
Mm.
The morale of the 9th, was it still reasonable when you were...
Oh, yes. My feeling all along was that they were a good fighting formation. I don't know that they changed very much. I don't know that our contribution was particularly professional, but on the whole, I think they did a good job of work. But the Sicilian campaign, really, as far as one now looks... on it from the present day is that it wasn't a market success particularly, and it was a combination there again of the American and English forces working together, and not always successfully, and the beginning of what would be to come, I think, in on the second front, when where Monty was going up there, wasn't he? So guess he was winding down a little bit.
Now, you were sent to the 3rd New Zealand General Hospital, which I believe was near Tripoli.
Yes.
And you'd been wounded in the calf of the leg. What sort of treatment did you get for it, or did it basically heal itself?
It healed itself. I mean, I had treatment all along, and it was somewhat sore. They gave me, I guess, sulfanamide, that sort of thing, and dressings every day. But I was walking for most of the time in the hospital. We did, you know, duty jobs in the hospital, helping them out, because they were a very good hospital, and the staff were first class, and they were receiving intakes of some very bad battle casualties. The odd one died during the night, this sort of thing, in pain. So it really was quite gruesome at times. Well, and we sort of helped out with the orderly. And we ponced up the front of the tent with stones and things, decorative of this sort of thing.
Where were you sent from there?
I was there about 25 days, and I had been fit for about the last week or so of that, really. They were just keeping us there for whatever benefit they could gain from us. And we were eventually discharged, a squad, and we were sent on to a transit camp in Tripoli, on the seashore, which was 155 transit camp. And story had it that there was about 12,000 in this camp. It spread right along the beach for miles and miles. And I know that when one queued up for a meal, the queue went on for... You saw it in the distance, winding along until it got to the actual dishing out spot, and one had to queue for hours for meals. The duties weren't very onerous. There was not an awful lot to do. I met up with people that I'd come abroad with. These people were sort of collecting there. It seemed to be the main collection area for anyone who'd had any sort of problems in North Africa or Sicily. So one had shell shock cases and people were recovering from wounds, mostly from the 50th Division and the 51st Division. These were all sort of the Desert Army people. And we just sort of passed the time aimlessly. There were the odd parades and things, but there was nothing very much organized. And one spent one's time, as far as I remember, trying to organize ways of not going back into action. And what I was concerned with trying to do was to get in the Royal Corps signals. Being a signaller, that seemed to be a possibility for me. So we sort of went through all the procedures of going to that. We had to go for interviews and all that sort of thing. But clearly it was all a complete waste of time because there were so many people on the fiddle, as it were, that there really wasn't much attempt to do anything for them, I guess.
You say you were trying not to go back. You'd had enough then, your experience.
Oh, yes. There didn't seem to be an awful lot of future in it. And clearly, one could become quite dead in the places that we were, and I didn't see a great deal of future in that. Particularly, and perhaps I could dwell on that now or later. Perhaps now. There was a great contempt, usually, for people who were in the front or close to the front, relative to those who were in base echelon positions, who, as I subsequently found, had a very pleasant army life, perhaps even better than they were enduring back home in England. Cushy billets and all this sort of thing. And this even obtained in our own battalions, that there were people who were in the base areas who had a relatively quiet, peaceful, quite remarkably pleasant life in the army, whereas there were those up front were really in the thick of it, were in danger of being killed, or had a most unpleasant type of life. And so you did get this camaraderie between people who were exposed to the extreme situations and those who we considered were base wallers, who really were somewhat beneath contempt. But that didn't stop us from wanting to join the base wallers if we got a chance, because there didn't seem to be anything very clever in necessarily being in the front line, because to all intents and purposes, one was making the same contribution to the war effort. So there we are. I mean, one didn't particularly volunteer to go and get killed. If that was the way that Providence so disposed, well, there we are. We could do very little about that. But you didn't particularly embrace it, if you could. So that was more or less our feelings at the time, I feel.
So you were at this base camp, the transit camp, mm-hmm. Towards the end of August into September.
September. Round about the first week or so of September, and I would think it'd be about September 8th or 9th, I'm not sure about the dates, but we were listening on the radio and we were conscious that we'd made landings. I think the landings in Italy came first at Salerno, and then I quite remember one evening we were just hanging around and listening on the radio to the news that the Italians had decided to withdraw from the war, and they'd sort of made arrangements to have peace. And I think Bedolio had taken over or something of that order. But anyway, our feelings of that was that if the Italians were out of the war, that this would mean that there wouldn't be much of a campaign in Italy. We sort of thought that was the end of the Italian campaign and that the Germans would just withdraw. Hadn't realised that the opposite would take place. So it was against that background that a week later, I would think, about September the 15th, we were all dragged out, I think early morning. Perhaps we were even told the night before that we had to be ready to move out early morning. And we all had our full kit with us. And we were paraded. And I think about 2,000, I'm not sure about the numbers, but between 1 and 2,000, I would guess, were taken down to the harbour and embarked on these three cruisers. They were, the one we were on was Charybdis, and there were also the Scylla and the Aurora, and these were just naval cruisers that were utilized in transporting this detachment from North Africa to Salerno. And the background to all of that was that the Salerno bridgehead was at a critical point at that moment in time, that they'd landed all their troops and hadn't really managed to secure a broad enough bridgehead. The Eighth Army was supposed to have been coming up, led by Monty, to meet up with them, and he hadn't made particularly swift progress for one reason or another. And the bridgehead, which was the Fifth Army bridgehead, commanded by Mark Clark, about which there are other problems, I guess, was in a very critical state at one moment in time. And what happened was, clearly someone panicked. At what level, I don't know. But they just grabbed for some reinforcements that were convenient just to ram into this particular military situation. What could have been a debacle, I guess. I mean, it would have been a tremendous defeat had we to pull out of Salerno, having used so much resources to get in there. That was the background. This is what really transpired later on. However, we were not aware at all clearly where we were bound for. It was known that I think the 50 Division was in North Africa somewhere, and the 51st probably somewhere else. We might have been going to Sicily, I guess. It's all against the backcloth of the fact that Monty had promised these divisions and the Desert Eighth Army that they would be returning to England. And the people that were on that draft were by and large all ex-members of either the Scottish divisions of the 51st or Durham's. There were a few others, but that was mostly the composition. So we were unaware, really, of where we were going until the captain, who had sealed orders apparently, read them out during the course of the voyage and told us we were going to Salerno. And then that was the beginning of a fair bit of feeling. There wasn't much else to do. People were talking about the situation, so there was a lot of barrack room discussions going on and barrack room lawyers laying down.
What was being said?
Well, the Scottish lads, the jocks in particular, were very unhappy about going back or about going into Salerno because they didn't regard that as their particular problem. They regarded themselves as being part of the 51st Division with Monty, who had promised them, incidentally, that they would go back to England. So they were really thinking of it was their turn to go to England. To be honest, they'd had quite a good spell. They had achieved some remarkable victories. They'd served Monty well. And clearly, it was a twin-edged thing. He had promised them that it would be their turn to go home and see their families and get revitalised, but clearly we all knew that part of it also was that there would be the part of the Second Front that was being planned at the time. That I don't know whether they fully appreciated that or didn't really accept that. All they knew was that they had been promised by Monty that they would go home, and had it not been for the fact of being wounded or whatever in Sicily, that they would be with their battalion to go home. And the people who were in the Salerno bridgehead were not Jock battalions, and therefore they had no part of that. They didn't see themselves as being involved, and therefore they ought not to be there.
Did they say what they were going to do about it on the boat?
No, this was just talk.
What about you, Durhams? What were you lot saying?
Not an awful lot. At that point in time, we were just listening to them and just talking amongst ourselves and saying, oh, yes, it was a dirty trick and all this sort of thing. Even the Durhams thought it was a bit of a dirty trick because, But for the turn of events, everybody would have been going home, you see. Instead of that, they were going into a whole new ball game, a new area of war, with no finite end to it at all, of course, as far as one could tell.
That's generally what the Durhams were saying. Did you fully? Would that represent your view at the time as well?
I don't think I'd crystallise view very much at that moment in time, Alan. I don't think I was terribly keen to be going back into action, of course. I suppose that was my main preoccupation, really. Part of it also was this business about Monty. I mean, they still had some sort of respect and affection for Monty, and it wasn't with Monty or whatever. It was with an American general, you know, and all this sort of thing. So there were any number of different strands of reasons why people used them either deliberately or unconsciously to argue against why they shouldn't be going into Salerno as such. Anyway, the cruisers were all jam-packed. I mean, there weren't any proper facilities for troops, so we just slept where we could and everywhere we went. The sailors were very good. They coped as well as they were able to under the circumstances and provided us with reasonable food and so forth. And we eventually arrived outside of Salerno, where I remember, I think it was the Warspite who was standing offshore shelling Salerno at odd times, and it looked like there was a battle going on some distance inland. But we landed quite peacefully and quietly on a part of the front and then marched some way inland. I think all in all we possibly had two or three stops before we sort of finalised on this particular position in a field. We didn't have all our kit at that moment in time. We just had sort of a walking kit, a fighting kit. So in a sense we weren't completely kitted out. That came a bit later. So we were in this field with nothing else to do but just talk amongst ourselves about the situation. And the jocks said definitely that they weren't going to go and fight, that they would definitely refuse to go.
Had you been told where you'd be going yet?
No. I don't think we were aware that there were any DLI. I mean, the 16th DLI, I guess, to the 6th and the 9th, who were regular battalions, probably wasn't regarded as being of the same calibre, so there was a bit of snobbishness in it. Even if we were aware of the 16th, I don't think anybody would have thought very much about going into the 16th at that point in time. So, as I would put it, I think, it had, the jocks had this sort of tribal feeling about it in terms of their argument that they were Scottish soldiers, should be in Scottish divisions, so it was a nationalistic thing from their point of view, as well as everything else. The Durhams didn't have that sort of aspect to it. So to most of it was more like trade union solidarity than it was anything else. Oh, we'll all stick together, lads, and they can't do anything to us, sort of thing. So it had little to do with war or whatever. And I remember there was this tall, red-headed Geordie sergeant, and I was in two minds. I thought perhaps I ought to help them, but on the other hand, I really had only been in the 9th DLI about 3 weeks. So I really hadn't very much of a case to be anywhere, truth be told. So I went to him and I said, you know, what should I do? He said, oh, lad, he said, you should support the Jocks and the Durhams, he said. They've been treated badly. Then we all stick together, we'll be all right. He says, you stick with me. So I said, oh, fair enough then. So we were all then officially on a mutiny. What happened? They provided us with food, compo rations, and there was this large area of tomatoes growing quite close by. So we had tomatoes with everything whilst we were there. We had them as stews and cold and what have you. We stripped this fellow's field of tomatoes for him. And we lived quite well, and we cleaned up our weapons and talked about the situation, and it was quite a pleasant 2 days or whatever.
At what point did you actually refuse to do something?
Well, it really didn't crystallise until they actually brought up all our kit. See, until we had everything, which included kit bags and so forth, which always tend to go in the sort of rear reserve positions. They're kept in the ship's hold and that sort of thing. And you sort of pick them up later on, and you're just left with your fighting kit, your immediate army kit that you've got. When you get your kit bags and your big pack and all that sort of thing, that means you're complete. You've got all of your kit. Then you can move. Then you are mobile. And that came up in one morning, I remember. And then after that point in time, we really didn't have any excuse for not going anywhere. Before that, we couldn't have gone anywhere because we weren't fully accoutred, as it were, but once we'd got our kit up, and at that point in time we were in a mutiny situation.
So what were you told to do? They
actually we were told that I think a fella came and chatted to us first, and then either on the same day or the next day we had this we all were paraded, and this chap tore out, I think he was a major, he might have been the brigadier or whatever, but he said in effect that there had been mistakes made. They were sorry that it had happened the way that it did, and that every effort would be made after the immediate problem to try and get people back into their proper formations or whatever. But for the moment, that we really didn't have any option but to obey orders and report for duty. And we would be posted to appropriate battalions within the Fifth Army, the English side of the Fifth Army. And then the riot act was read out, as far as I remember. I get the feeling the riot act was read out. And having that read out to you, then you sort of appreciate the enormity of what you're into, that quite clearly you were disobeying lawful orders and could be shot or whatever. I mean, when the Riot Act is read out in those situations, it brings a chill to anybody's mind. And the order was then given that all of those who wished now to obey their lawful orders were to centralise with all of their kit in the centre of this field. So I thought to myself, after all this, I'm a bloody fool, really. What have I got that I can say is any sort of an excuse for doing what I'm doing. So I wandered off in the centre with my kit, and lo and behold, there was my friend, the red-headed sergeant, organising the collecting together of the kit, you know. And I said, I thought you said we all ought to stay together and we'd be all right. He says, oh, lad, he said, you have to obey orders at the end of the bloody day. He says, you can't beat the army, so I reckoned if he went, then the least I could do was to go as well. Quite a number of people, I would guess a good half, perhaps, at that moment in time, collected themselves together, were marched off, and subsequently, we at least ended up with the 16th DLI. I do recall that perhaps a day or so later, further people came along. It was a sort of a dribble situation. But that ultimately, I think they were left with a hardcore who did apparently finish up in prison and court-martialed and so forth. But those that were left had certainly had a long opportunity, really, for reconsideration.
Well, when you left, I mean, you were all in, you know, gathered together, and the riot act was read, and then you got your kit and went over. What did the ones who were staying solid, so to speak, what did they do when you went off, you know, to...
They just sort of withdrew themselves back, you know, out of the area, just to one side, as far as I remember.
They didn't say anything or attempt to persuade you not to?
I don't recall. They may have said something. They may have been words, but I don't really recall at all.
There was no hard feelings then between the two groups?
I'm not conscious of it, I must say. Looking back on it, I think, really, because I know for a fact that later on, after the immediate... Well, to start at the beginning, the whole affair was unnecessary, truthfully, because the existing troops in the bridgehead managed to contain the situation. They managed, in fact, to repel the German attacks, hold the position, and the bridgehead was in no danger at all, at about the time, really, that we were being, you know, brought into it. So, with a certain amount of good sense, the whole affair need not have happened the way it did. Because we were used, ultimately, to form reinforcements for the troops in the companies and battalions in the bridgehead who'd lost people during the Salerno campaign. So we were necessary as reinforcements, I guess. But the original purpose was unnecessary because that flap, that panic, had ceased to exist and was unnecessary as it transpired afterwards. But this is all with hindsight. My view of it all now, and there have been subsequent programs on television where there were one or two who had gone the whole hog and finished up in prison, I think, and had quite a rough time of it, who had been very bitter about it all. But my feeling really was, to be fair, the army establishment, behaved remarkably well under the circumstances, truthfully, because, rightly or wrongly, they were fearful of some military problem. They took the advantage of having whatever troops were supposedly available and intended to use them. And it was natural, it was a proper military decision, and that anyone who, in fact, didn't obey orders was, in fact, in a mutinous state. And it's fairly obvious to me that no other country, no other army would have accepted that situation for one moment. But there was some feeling, and there is some feeling now after the event, but I do recall some month or so later that there was a signal, and because I was on the telephone exchange at the time, there was a signal came along from headquarters to the effect that anyone who had transferred this way from the 50th Division or 51st Division could apply to return to their own formations if they wanted to. So, in the event, I don't think many people did, truthfully.
Why not?
Well, all sorts of reasons, I guess. Some were like me, I think, who probably thought that at the end of the day, it would be all very nice to go back to England. One was going back to the Second Front, which by general acceptance was going to be no pushover, that was likely to be a very dangerous and deadly sort of battle anyway. So on the whole, we felt that we were probably rather better off in Italy than we would be in the Second Front, so we stayed where we are. That's one possibility. Second possibility was that due to the fact that they'd been brought in for this particular reason, there were quite a lot more than were required. And I know